Welcome to Unlocking the Hidden Value of Your Life Insurance with Mark Murky and Rob Haney from Life Insurance Settlements. This show is designed to help retirees and their advisors understand the basics of a life settlement. In this podcast, we show you how to get more from the sale of your life insurance policy versus lapse or surrender, and how using life settlements can increase assets under management. Mark and Rob ignite conversations on how to look for opportunities and navigate the life settlement process so you and your clients can enjoy a comfortable retirement. Now on to the show.
Hello and welcome to the Life Settlements Podcast, Rob Haney and Mark Murky. Gentlemen, it's been a while since we spoke. Good to be with you again. How are you?
All's well down here in Florida, Bill. Everywhere else in the world, it's cold and freezing and nasty. So our 70-degree day and a little overcast, we'll take it today.
Yeah, well, I'm speaking to you from 14-degree weather. So,
well, that's why we live in South Florida.
There you go. So what's on the table today?
I second Mark. It's a terrible day that we have to live and drive to work in the 60s and look at people in coats and scarves and sweaters and mittens. So we'll take it. We'll take what we can. So what we have on the launch pad today is a good friend of mine and someone that we work with and our industry knows well, Vince Granary. Vince is the CEO and managing member of Predicted Resources. And what they do is they provide actuarial services or life expectancies, we'll call it for our business's purposes. And I met Vince back in the mid 2007, 2008 area when he was with another company. And I've watched him leave that company and start his own business and be very successful. And I consider him to be probably the most intelligent person there is when it comes to this topic, which is explaining the world of life expectancy and how it meshes with the life settlement industry and business as it sits today. So without further ado, I'll introduce you to Vince Granary. And Vince, if you'd be so kind, kind of tell us a little bit about your history, starting with where you came from before you got into the life life insurance or life settlement industry.
Sure. And I'll pay you for that kind introduction
sure.
Later. Very nice. Anyway, I'm an actuary by training. Graduated many, many more years ago than I'd care to say it from Ball State University with a degree in actuarial science. Went to Harvard Business School to sort of round off things and almost immediately got involved in financial services, whether it be on the pension side or the life insurance side. And over the first 30 years of my career, spent a great deal of time either as chief actuary or chief financial officer of life insurance organizations, and was responsible for developing a lot of the universal life products that you see that are relevant in the life settlement business. So my background there comes from life insurance, and very familiar with those products. So not too soon before Rob and I ran into each other in 07, I found myself in a consulting job working for a life settlement provider, and at that time was wooed away to the life expectancy underwriting business because of my background in actuarial science, principally in my relationships with some folks in the life settlement business. And that's where I really became introduced to the concept of life insurance and life expectancy underwriting as it relates to folks settling their policies.
Perfect. That was an interesting time because the business is just coming out of the viatical era and it was now slipping into what I call the financial services sector. So we went as an industry dealing with the consumers directly, and then we now were dealing with financial planners, state planners, whomever, who had some say with respect to their clients' life insurance policies, what they should and shouldn't do with them. So education was key. And I'm going to tee Mark up here because what's happened is, we still, as we sit here in 2023, 2024 now, we still have an education deficit. They don't understand the basics of life settlements, let alone why somebody's life expectancy is A and why another's is B. So, Mark, you want to ask Vince your first question? Do you think it was a good one?
Well, yeah. I mean, when you start talking about life settlements and someone who wants to sell their policy, there's really two main drivers. You know, the one driver is what's the cost of the policy? If I'm going to buy it, what are the future premiums? And then the second is the mortality, the underwriting life expectancy of that insured, which I know it's a morbid topic. And that's what I say to advisors who bring me their case. They say, hey, I know this is going to sound morbid, but I am going to be able to send your client's medical records out to various different life expectancy, you know, third-party companies, and they're all going to come back to me. In addition to the buyers, they have their own life expectancy underwriters. They're all going to come back to me, and they're going to tell us what your client's mortality rating, i.e. life expectancy, is, which, boy, that's a, you know, it's a scary thing to even consider. But again, that's the two main drivers that you look at in a life settlement evaluation. But one thing that I've seen over my 23 years, and Rob, you're even longer, is, you know, we can go out and get six different life expectancy reports on the same insured with the same medical records, sending to the same six company, or the same medical records to six different companies. And the reports will a lot of times come back different. One might be 10 years, one might be 11, one might be 15, one might be 7. And we have to convey that to our advisor or to the seller, usually in an average number. But Vince, the question would be, you know, why do you see there being such discrepancy in life expectancy underwriting between the companies that exist out there? In my opinion, there's six main companies that a buyer can go to. But why such a different in life expectancy underwriting do we see between those companies?
Right. And although I don't often see that range of life expectancies beyond what we look at, but I think there's a couple things that can be said here. First of all, let's just say this really shouldn't be a topic that folks shy away from, it being sort of a morbid topic. If you go out to buy a pension, if you go out and take an annuity, for example, you're basically presenting that same risk profile to the insurance company that you're presenting to the life settlement company. So there are many, many different financial services providers that are looking at your risk the same way the life settlement industry looks at your risk, that being longevity being the risk, that you'll live too long. So it's not that uncommon. Early on, there was a lot of reference to that sort of morbid nature, but really that's a misnomer. There's a lot of folks that on the surface may have an interest in your mortality, and the way they do it is not individual in nature. They look at grouping lots of risks together, and that's what the life settlement folks do as well. So let's get that, you know, with having said that, now let's go back to the meat of your question there, Mark. I think there are different perspectives that each of the life settlement and life expectancy underwriters provide. And sometimes it's, you know, the fact of where they've come from. You've mentioned six, and I don't know who makes up the six. Hopefully we're in the top six somewhere. But, you know, we have an actuarial and a data-driven approach to things. But we also add sort of a human element. So there's another company, for example, that's very, very data driven. And once the computer tells them the answer, it's out on the page. So we share a lot of the same interest in terms of using the data as best we can. But we look at it a little differently. The data which informs us is sort of a looking backward. That's an actuarial exercise. Actuaries sort of look backwards to forecast the future. But we also have to look forward and see, you know, what's happening with respect to, you know, trends in health, right? As cancer becomes less and less important. And you mentioned heart disease earlier. Very, you know, in 1995, that was the number one killer. It still may be the number one killer, but it used to be 50% ahead of cancer, and now they're pretty much neck and neck. And that's because cancers have not grown or fallen as a cause of death, but heart disease has fallen a great deal. So we like to add something to that data approach. There's other life expectancy providers that prefer a more subjective approach, and they employ folks that have years of experience in the industries, whether they be health related industries or life insurance industries, and those folks using their experience and background would then, without the use of data, determine a life expectancy based on their life's experiences. So you have differences in perspective. You mentioned the data often being the same. Sometimes data is not the same. We don't all see exactly the same medical records. But I'd say by and large, it's the perspective that people bring. Some folks are very well versed in overall human mortality, but I think we're going to talk a little bit later, but I'll just give some foreshadowing here that this particular segment of the market, those folks that settle their policies and try and sell their policies, very, very different than folks that say even purchased a life insurance policy, right? And I think going back to 2008 when Rob and I ran into each other, one of the other things, in addition to that education effort, is that the data was prior to the 2008-2009 era, the data was not plentiful with respect to our business. And we, those players in the business concluded quite fairly that, hey, these folks that settle their policies should behave an awful lot like people who purchase life insurance. And that was a very logical conclusion. Nothing wrong with that logic, but it just happens to be false. We are a small segment of that population that purchases life insurance policies. And for example, during COVID, where you heard, hey, 15% higher mortality, more deaths, that applied to the general population. It did not apply as directly to the elder part of the life insurance population, and it applied even less to the portion of the life insurance population that actually settled their policies. So because of that, folks who are underwriters that may have a perspective on overall human mortality and even life insurance mortality may differ in their approach, and that might lead to some different results.
So I'll jump in. So what I heard there, and I think I've kind of expected to hear that, there is a human element to underwriting, just like in the life insurance world, where a guy can go out to buy new life insurance and get 10 different ratings, and one carrier may give him standard, one carrier may give him preferred, one may say, hey, you're rated. So our worlds kind of are alike when it comes to underwriting, in that there is a human element, and that if we're sharing the same information, mostly there is some subjective things that will differ between underwriters, correct?
Right. It's almost like the opposite side of the same coin. But sure, there is a big difference between life insurance and life settlement underwriting. In the life insurance business, when somebody gets to a certain level, you find out, geez, they've got diabetes and they've had a heart attack. There's no way they get a policy. Right. And so the life insurance underwriter then crosses that name off the list and on to the next case. Whereas in life settlements, we need to provide a mortality curve. We need to provide that information so that the investors can rely on it, and also those selling their policies can get the fair price.
Yeah, and you mentioned something there that I just had a recent case, and you talk about the mortality curve. And it made me think about this case, in that a mortality curve, and you can explain this better than I can, is simply you take, say, 100 lives, and then you give a median or mean range, meaning, hey, at the top of this curve, this is that client's expected life expectancy. Is that kind of, am I explaining that correctly as far as the mortality curve? Explain that a little bit more, if you could.
Sure. Yeah. And really, life expectancies are often described as so many months. He's got a 79-month life expectancy, but that's really shorthand. And what that is shorthand for is what I can call the survival curve. The survival curve, as you said, starts up and everyone's around. So it's up near one, and then it sort of moves down. along as time goes on, we have a lower and lower percentage chance of living to that age. So we may start out, the fact of the matter is we all look very healthy. We're all feeling good. Tomorrow, one of us could die or one of us could live for another 25 years. And the survival curve lays that out and says, okay, starting from right now, what are your probability of living to a year from now, 2 years from now, so on and so forth, until the chance of you living another year is zero. And that is really what the life expectancy is. The number in months is what I call shorthand. That's an easy way to describe it, but it really doesn't capture the nuances of the curve.
So that's funny you say that, because I think Vince told me that at one of our meetings or something, you drew the bell curve in essence and said, okay, point A and then point B was the very end of it. And you say, what's that? And nobody, including myself, could answer. And you said, that's the life expectancy. That's the whole line. You could die tomorrow. You could survive past what everybody thinks you're going to live. But if we do 100 lives, right in the middle is where probably most of them are going to land. And that's what our job is. And that helped me explain it better to some of my clients. My clients would be like, well, he was wrong. Well, I said, sometimes he's wrong the other way too. He said 79 months, as you alluded to earlier, and your client passed away in 60. So is that a good life expectancy, or is that just one that just happened to die sooner rather than later? So once they got comfortable with the fact that it is certainly an inexact science, nothing, you can't predict this, otherwise you'd be a trillionaire. I'd be talking to you from space. But it helps people understand that this is as good as we can do right now. And we look forward to the future and some of the things on the horizon. So I think now's a good time for you to tell me, Vince, if you will. Oh, Mark's got a question. Sorry, Mark. Go ahead.
Yeah, we'll wrap up the mortality curve, but if I wanted to point out that if you're a listener, and we kind of alluded to this, that it is just a curve. Out of 100 lives, we give you a mean or a median and say this is when most of the insureds or whatever with this particular health ailment will pass away. And I had a case, that's what I just mentioned, where we had a life expectancy of anywhere from 1 year to 6 years on a particular case. And we share that information with this particular client, had a large policy, told him everything because, our offers were off the charts. And I had to tell the advisor, I said, you need to let this client know that, the life expectancy you're coming back for anywhere from a year to 6 years. And the client wanted to sell his policy because he had it in his mind. He was outliving this diagnosis of cancer that he had, and he was going to be on the other side of the curve. So if you're an advisor listening to this or consumer or whatever it is, that when you get this life expectancy information back, it's invaluable, number one, because if you want to make a decision on selling your life insurance policy or not, go look at a life settlement valuation. And I say that because one of the data that we give you is an average or expected life expectancy from multiple different underwriters. And you can decide for yourself if you think you're going to beat that life expectancy or not. So a lot of people, when you say, oh yeah, I have a 79-month life expectancy, they're like, oh my God, I'm going to die in 79 months. No, that's just a mean number. You might come before that. You might come after that. So that's an important topic to bring to the attention of listeners there.
Good point, Mark. Vince, back to this, before I get ahead of myself, so I was going to talk about the future. We'll talk about the future in context of this next question I have for you. I have financial planners that have relationships, and I honestly don't even know if it's with you, who buy life expectancies on their clients, not to settle the policy, but to help them plan. Is that something that you see in the future for your company and others just like you, that they would be—
Sure. Yeah, it's interesting because that is one aspect that we have tried as an industry to pursue with clients. If you go online now and you're trying to chart your financial future, you can find a lot of these life expectancy calculators, but they're total black boxes and they're often overly simplistic. Because they may ask you a few questions, but there's nothing like having the full set of medical records from which to then determine somebody's life expectancy. I would also say, though, that in doing so, it's important to note the population, right? I wouldn't say you're going to use the general population for that exercise, but would you use a life settlement population? Possibly, but probably not. So as much as I would love to second the motion that this is going to be a superior method, and I believe it is a superior method, I don't think it'll become prevalent necessarily until such time as folks, maybe, as you say, are more educated on what the nature of this beast is, because nothing could be more important, right? If you go to a financial planner today, generally they'll say, we're going to give you a financial plan that lasts you to age 95. Now, how do you feel about that? Well, I don't know. I don't know if I'm going to live to age 95 or not, but I'd sure like to have a probability distribution to help me. So I need to say, well, wait a minute. Both my folks died in their 70s. They had heart disease. I need to have a plan that goes to 95 or al contraire, because picking the right parents are the best is the best method for living a long life. So both my parents lived into their 90s. I think I better plan to age 99 or 105 or whatever it is. Having this kind of information from professionals like ourselves, I think would be very valuable, and I hope people utilize that more in the future than they have.
And I apologize, because when I say my agents and Mark has them too, you know, we in a business full of acronyms, the HNW or high net worth client, these guys will talk about the ultra high net worth client. So this is part of their financial planning. They go out and buy these life expectancies because they want to show it in front of their clients, so they understand, okay, this is why I'm doing X, this is why we're doing Y, and they have a better idea. And it's helped them plan for their future, and I'm sure sell them a whole bunch of things they may or may not need it, but that's irrelevant. I don't know that. So because I want you to talk about this, because I've heard you say this before, tell us a little bit about where we are today and where we're going in terms of what you do for a living. That's
sure. And as I alluded to a little earlier, when I joined the business, we had just crossed the line from not being able to define life settlement mortality to being able to define it. There was enough data. We had crossed maybe 250,000 lives at that point in time. And that was a watershed moment, because then we didn't have to rely on life insurance data or population data any longer. We could look at our own data set. And not that that doesn't mean that we stopped there, because over time now, since 2008, we've probably added another 200,000 lives to what we are able to assess. And so as time goes on, more data means more accuracy. And now it's a matter of saying, okay, how do we get that data more quickly? How do we assess things more quickly? So we still rely greatly on the written clinical notes and test results. But one of the things that's happened in the last couple of years with the advent of electronic health records is that a number of our clients are producing these records electronically, and they are equal in terms of the detail and the number of visits. All the visits are encompassed in an electronic transfer versus grabbing those records, calling the doctor's office, having them summarized and sent to us. So we're seeing some improvements there. I think we have many, many more improvements to come. We've been experimenting with using the electronic health records that don't include the clinical notes. They include things like prescription drug history, test results, things like that. But more and more, as everything becomes available electronically and instantaneously, the state of our art will improve. We also have situations where, and again, we sort of alluded to this a little bit before, a lot of times the actuarial approach is to look backward, you pick up enough data, and then you develop your mortality curves from that. Now we're able to see the nature of the medical research that's being done And I mentioned heart disease was a big one that has went from the number one killer to being tied for number one, and it's gone down quite a bit. Now cancer research, which if you look at the research that's out there, the heart disease research dominated the last part of the 20th century. And now the first part of the 21st century, cancer research dominated. So when we look at a cancer, for example, when Rob and I first met in 2008, multiple myeloma was a killer. It was an 18-month LE. Now I'm issuing LEs that are 14 years with multiple myeloma because those medical advancements are such. And I can see with some lung cancers, especially, the research is proving that, you know, people's life expectancies are extending. At the same time, other types of things, for example, I think there's certain bladder and colorectal cancers that even with all the research have not advanced at all in the last 20 years. So we're able to have more data. That's a good thing. We're able to interpret the research that's going. We're able to get things more quickly. And all those things are good for making more accurate predictions and for producing, you know, a fair deal for all the involved parties.
I have a question. So you mentioned this. How much does a parent's DNA contribute into your underwriting or any of the underwriting out there? Because I get that question from time to time where an advisor will bring me a case, we'll get the medical records, and that advisor will just sit and say up and down, hey, his mom only lived to 78 and his dad only lived to 75 and he's 65 and he has similar health ailments as they, so he's not going to make it to his mid-70s either. And I say, well, we're going to find out. Is there a direct correlation between parents and their sibling, or whatever you want to call it, kids, when it comes to life expectancy underwriting? Because again, I have advisors that, man, they'll tell me their parents died, so should he or so should she. And I said, well, we'll find out. Do you have a comment on that?
No, absolutely. For in both directions, right? If somebody's parents have lived to their 80s, or especially have lived, you know, past their mid 90s, that's a strong indicator for longevity. On the other hand, right? We have somebody who has some genetic diseases. There's heart disease. There's different lung issues that are also hereditary and have a huge impact, even finding that, you know, some of the cognitive issues. And again, one of the changes since I've witnessed as heart disease goes down, as cancer is not rising any longer, these folks who would have died of a heart attack are now, you know, being subject to some cognitive issues. And so we're seeing dementias and things like that rise dramatically as a cause of death. So these are situations that all have to be, you know, taken into account. But interestingly, you know, for example, if your parents had some heart issues, sometimes that informs you and you take better care of yourself. You know, dad smoked even though he had some emphysema and things like that, or even though he had a heart attack, I'm not going to smoke. So sometimes you find that that family history, even if it's a bad family history, it's led to some sort of opposite outcomes.
Okay. I got one more to fire at you, see if you have an answer for this. So if you, and you said, you know, how much things have changed in your 20 odd years. You mentioned melanoma many years ago was almost, you know, not a death sentence, but a very, very shortened LE, not anymore. If you had to look into your crystal ball, or even just look at the current landscape, what would be the top three maybe health ailments that you see that are leading towards a good life settlement candidate, i.e. lower mortality? Are there certain health ailments out there that we need to be aware of and share with our advisors and they can share with us? Got an answer to that for that?
Wow. I would say nothing like putting the guy on the spot.
Absolutely. But,
you know, I am seeing, and I mentioned one, cognitive, right? If you're seeing some, especially early signs of dementia before you know, at a young age. I believe that those are the folks, especially when accompanied by some kind of physical maladies, inability to do activities of daily living. If you see some slippage there, I believe that would be one. There are certain cancers that, have, despite our efforts, are incurable, and I can't get into the whole list of them. And I would also say pulmonary issues are another one where we have to look forward and see that they are becoming a more important key indicator of a lower life expectancy in the future. So I would put those three together. I'd put the cognitive issues. We have some pulmonary issues. And then certain cancers that remain incurable despite our best efforts.
All right, I got one. This is one you probably never have been asked, but I'm going to ask it to you anyway. Mark and I, and other people in my firm, and other individuals like us, and like companies, et cetera, across the country, talk to insurers directly or vis-a-vis their representatives, and we tell them that we would like to see all of your medical records, because that will give individuals like you and your firm the best chance to get the best life expectancy. Could you reiterate for me why that's important? Because the agents sometimes think if they just send you a general practitioner's case notes and want to know why you can't give a low life expectancy because he's got X, Y, and Z, and there's nowhere in the notes that say that. It's amazing we still have these discussions, but you know, we're talking to an expert now. So what's the ideal set of records that you'd like to see? How far back would you like them to go? And what type of doctors, specialists related to the illnesses you'd like to see? Do we not need to see podiatrists if there's nothing wrong with your feet? Dermatology records if there's no cancers. I tell them, you don't need to give me those, but they'll just try and shortchange the process. And I keep telling them, no, more is better in this case. It's better.
So yeah, typically it's best to let us decide what's important or not and to send the records. We'd like to see 3 years, the most recent 3 years of records.
Okay.
I think, you know, one of the things is there's comorbidities. I'm trying to think of one that would be particular germane, where something that seems sort of innocent, but then when combined with something else, is a huge negative indicator for longevity. And none are coming to mind. There's some that work the other way. It's interesting that you know, someone with high cholesterol, generally for most of our databases, the only one that's an exception to this is very, very old people. If you've got hyperlipidemia with statins and their ubiquity these days, it's almost a good thing because they're so protective of heart disease. But sure. We like to see, again, as many of the records as we can for at least 3 years.
Three. We usually say five. People try and get away with two. It's just good to have them because I'll send the podcast to them when they don't want to give me more than one page.
Right. Well, the progression, right? You know, when you've got 5 years, you really can sense the progression of the disease, and that's a big deal because again, it's not enough to know what the snapshot is. It's more and more we're being asked. To be fair to all parties, it's great to be able to see a progression and be able to ascertain it.
I'm gonna ask one last question as we near the end here. You know, in our industry, the way we underwrite, the way we get your underwriting opinion is to go and collect the medical records, like you just mentioned, for the last 3 to 5 years, go get them from their internist and any specialist and deliver those medical records over to a company like yours. Now, it might take us a week, it might take us 4 weeks to go get those medical records, and it might cost us $50, it might cost us $1,050. Whatever it is, that's what we assume is a life expectancy, or excuse me, a life settlement company. We pay for that. And it costs us a lot of money sometimes. Get your crystal ball out. Do you foresee that process changing for buyers, providers, underwriters, where they're not collecting medical records and they're simply going another route via a blood draw, saliva test, urine, whatever it is out there? I don't know. That's you. Do you see anything happening in the industry 2 years, 5 years, 10 years down the road to shorten our time frame to make a more accurate prediction of life expectancies and to lessen our costs, by the way, of collecting medical records at $500 a pop. You see anything coming?
Yeah, I think there's a potential for that because the veracity of electronic health records have improved greatly. But, you know, alongside that is this is the privacy concerns that have also multiplied exponentially. So it's a matter of letting those play out, because there is if we can reach a, you know, I'll call it a common platform, if you will. I guess now the big deal, like, for example, in electronic vehicles, does the Tesla plug or does the other plug win out? And it looks like Tesla's going to win, which nobody would have predicted 5 years ago, because they were doing their own thing. Sony and Betamax, you know, you guys are all too young for this, but not me. When I was a kid, it was, would Sony win or will Betamax win? VHS or Sony, who's going to win that? And again, no dominant design ensued. And the real advancement in the recording technology, and now I believe the advancement in electronic vehicles, it only occurs after the dominant design is established. And we don't have that dominant design with electronic health records, but we're working on it. So I can't give you the time frame. Is it going to be 2 years from now or 5 years from now? But I can say that a lot of work has been done toward getting that dominant design. And if we can then couple that with, you know, proper documentation so the privacy concerns are lessened, you're going to see the cost and the costs go down and the speed go up.
But you still think it's all going to be medical record driven? You don't see any test coming out there that someone can give you their saliva and say, here's your life expectancy.
No, it's interesting because I sit on an actuarial committee now that talks about the use of different things. And they're talking about wearables and other data like that. And I think wearable data is, you know, can be very useful. But I think the value of that is highly overstated, right? It helps on an individual situation. I wear one of these Apple Watches because I had a heart attack 10 years ago and I want to know if I get AFib or something like that. And I think there's some value, but in terms of, you know, that changing the direction of life expectancy underwriting or even life insurance underwriting, it's still way up in the air. And if I had to bet on it, I would bet on the no side.
Good enough. This has been great. This has been informative. I got to say, I went into this going, all right, we're going to talk about actuarial life expectancy underwriting. Boy, it's going to be boring. But you know what? It's been good. I've enjoyed hearing what you've had to say for sure. And hopefully our listeners will enjoy and understand the backside of our industry, which, like I mentioned in, you know, earlier, you know, there's a couple of drivers that drive a life settlement offer, and one of them is right here in front of us. That's understanding your mortality and getting life expectancies from, you know, multiple different carriers, if you want to call them that. So this has been good. I appreciate it, Vince.
I mean, like, I'll second it. Thank you, Vince. It was great. And I knew you would be great. That's why you're on the show. But at the end of the day, life settlements is interesting. Life expectancies are unique. I've had the privilege and honor of being in the business for a long time and actually delivering life expectancies to clients who have looked at it two ways. One, great, I'm going to sell my policy. And others who've looked at the life expectancy and believed it so much that made their policy more valuable and they kept it. And that's fine. Hmm. That's what we're about. We're trying to make life insurance more valuable, whether you take the cash now where you're alive or you leave it for your family because you realize the end may be near and you can afford to keep it. So I think it's a necessary part, component of our industry, and there's no better representative than you to deliver the news to everybody. So Tom, yeah. Bill, you can take it away. Vince, you want to say, finish?
Yeah, words? Rob, Mark, I just want to say it's just a pleasure to work with you guys. You guys are real pros in the business, and I love and endorse that you're continue to get the word out so that more folks can learn about this important option that they have.
Appreciate it.
Thanks, Vince.
Yeah, no, it's a fascinating conversation, a fascinating podcast, to be honest with you. Rob, Mark, if anybody's listening to this that want to reach out to you, maybe have further conversations, get maybe a little more information, what's the best way for them to do that?
Mark and or Rob and I can always be reached. My direct number is 954-326-9378. And my email, markm@lisettlements.com. That's how you reach me. And Rob?
rob@lisettlements.com is my email. Direct cell line is 954-599-4433.
Fascinating. Thanks, guys. Appreciate the conversation. Listeners, thank you. We appreciate you taking the time to listen. If you have not done so already, please hit the subscribe button right there in front of you and subscribe to the podcast. That way you will not miss another episode of this fascinating conversation. Life settlements, I will admit, is a new thing to me, and I've already had a couple of conversations with people who are also interested in learning more about it. And you can do so by listening to this podcast. If you liked it and you find it interesting, please share it with other people. Spread the word about the podcast. On behalf of Rob and Mark, I'm Bill Tucker. Thank you for listening and reminding you that you can go out today and make it a great day or not. It's your choice. Have a good one.
Thank you for listening to Unlocking the Hidden Value of Your Life Insurance, the show that helps you unlock the hidden value of life insurance. Click the follow button to be notified when new episodes become available. Visit our website at www.lisettlements.com or give us a call at our office line at 866-326-5433, extension 1017. You can also directly contact Mark Murky at 954-326-9378 and Rob Haney at 954-599-4433.